I quickly just want to introduce our next presenter. Today we have Tim Brady doing his presentation on The Price is Right, Consumer Behaviors and Pricing Strategies. Tim is with Whetstone Station Restaurant and Brewery. He's been passionate about craft beer since he started home brewing 25 years ago. In addition to running Whetstone Brewery, Restaurant, and Beer Garden, Tim has frontline hospitality experience, owning and operating an inn, craft beer bar, and campground and entertainment complex. Tim shares his passion for beer, technology, and marketing as an active member of the Brewers Association Board of Directors and as an instructor for the University of Vermont's Business of Craft Beer program. So join me in welcoming Tim Brady.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate that. Thanks for having me. I don't sit still well, so that's why I went with the wireless option. So I'm Tim Brady. I'm here today to talk to you. It's a little unique for me because normally in the beer industry I'm talking about brew pubs, service, that kind of thing. But I also am a strategist with a firm that works with large hotel and resort brands, and we do a lot of retail strategy. So this presentation, I'm assuming most of you have a retail element. So we've tailored this to be specific to what you do. And what we're going to talk about today is avoiding, obviously, any of the antitrust issues and all. Just generic strategies, how consumers perceive price. What do they think about specific actions or strategies or displays or signage? We're going to get into the nitty-gritty about how a consumer reacts to pricing. If you haven't picked one up already, when you come in, I'm just going to put these in the back in case, or if you guys just spread them through in case anyone didn't get one, just pass them back, kind of, good stretching morning exercises. But just take one of those. You don't have to do anything with it yet, but we're going to have a little bit of interactive conversation during this presentation. We're going to play a couple of little games, and those little sheets will help you. One thing I'm going to come back to over and over and over again this morning is what we call the anchor. The anchor is a very important part of pricing strategy. This is a term I'm going to refer to time and time again. And we're going to jump right in with one of the interactive pieces and discuss kind of like the anchor wrapped around this example. I want you to look at the letter A on that little slip of paper you have there. This question is intentionally ambiguous. You aren't expected to know the answer, right? How many of us actually know the number, the percentage of U.S. craft breweries that have a flagship lager beer? I doubt other than maybe Bart, anybody could actually tell us the answer to that question. You're not supposed to know. So just give me a shot. This is interactive. Take a look at your form. Is it higher or lower? And then just take your wildest guess. But don't worry. Don't stress about it because this isn't meant for you to know the answer. It's meant for you to take a guess at an answer. And I'm just going to get really creepy and kind of walk around and look at what people might have written if you have pens. I guess I should. Yeah, we don't have a... I'm just going to take a couple of... Quick idea, quick look around, see what, does anyone on this side have pens? I guess we should have put that in the notes, it's a very, cool. Getting most of, and then take a stab at what you think that answer is. Awesome. Now, what's interesting is that, no matter the size of the room, no matter the size of the crowd, no matter how many people I present this same exact slide for, just as two researchers, Tversky and Kahneman did, back, I think, in the 80s, the same result can be predicted. And I just saw it happen here. The two different sides of this room, people on this side and people on this side, actually have different slips of paper. On this side of the room, your form said, is the percentage of U.S. craft breweries with a flagship lager beer higher or lower than 15%? On this side of the room, it said, is it higher or lower than 65%? Something remarkable happens every time we do this experiment. Now, Tversky and Kahneman did it with the United Nations using a different example, but I've adapted it to be beer. Doesn't matter. It always works. On this side of the room, the majority of people who had pens said that it was higher. And I saw a 21, I saw a 25, and I saw a 30. On this side of the room, the people who had pens said that the majority, or that it was lower than 65%. And I saw a 50, and I saw a 45, and I saw a 40. So why is that, right? Well, what happens is our brain is so wired to struggle to find the answer to a question that we will react to any piece of indication of what the answer might be. The simple fact of putting a 65 in the question on this side steered your answers higher. The simple fact of putting a 15 on your side steered your answers lower. That 15 and 65 had absolutely nothing to do, right? Like, I mean, it could have been any number. But what we were able to do is actually manipulate the way that you would answer that question because your brain is so starved for, like, I don't know. I don't know this answer. So what should I say? I don't know. It said 15, so it's probably near that. Maybe it's a little more. So I'm going to say more than 15, like 20, right? It's interesting because I can repeat that scenario in any size room with any group of people. And there's always, like, the outliers. But as a majority, that's what happens. And that's what we're going to talk about today. What is that 15? What is that 65? That's the anchor. The anchor I just talked about. Very important piece of pricing strategy. When we don't know what the answer is, when we don't know if a price is fair or unfair or how much something should cost, our brain subconsciously struggles to find some reference point to say, okay, that's what it should be. Now, is it higher or lower? So we're going to come back and back and back to that over and over again. One really good example of this that some of you might remember from years ago is McDonald's coffee spill case, right? Very famous case, poor older woman, actually, like, I could go into great depth of how manipulative this was of McDonald's in there, but, you know, basically this woman was the passenger in a car, handed a cup of scalding hot, like, way outside of, you guys are all in the brewing industry, right? It was a 210-degree cup of coffee. She put it between her legs to put the cream in and squeezed the cup, the top popped off, burned, third-degree burns. I mean, it's actually really horrific. As much as it was spun to be like, oh, she got all this money for coffee, it's a great case because during that jury trial, not once did the attorney ask for any specific amount of money. Never once. They never mentioned what they wanted. What they did was over and over and over say, is not this tragedy? I mean, if you've seen the pictures, it's brutal. It's nasty. Is not this tragedy worth, like, what McDonald's makes on coffee in one day? Wouldn't that be reasonable? You know, that this poor woman, look at this, I mean, like, just one day worth of, not the Big Macs, not the fries, I don't even, you know, but coffee. Wouldn't it be worth just what McDonald's makes on coffee in a day? Over and over and over, hammering that in. When the jury came back with their decision, what did they say? They awarded almost exactly the revenue of one day's coffee sales across all of McDonald's. Of course, that happens to be, you know, $2.4 million. So it sounded excessive, right? If I say she got $2 million because of, you know, spilled coffee on herself, that's the message that everybody was given, right, by the PR and marketing side of this. Yet, when you think about in the context of, like, one day's coffee sales for this huge brand, the numbers sound very different. So a couple of researchers, Chapman and Bornstein, back in 1996, with the popularity of this case getting all this media attention, did a little experiment, and they set up a jury trial, a mock jury trial. They created a courtroom, and they had, you know, an actor as in every role except for the actual jury. They repeated the exact same jury trial over and over and over to the, you know, to different people to see if changing what the actual attorney asked for would skew what the jury would award. Now, this case was exactly the same. It was scripted. Every single piece of evidence was the same. Every piece of dialogue was the same. The presentation by the only thing that they were changing is what the attorney asked for. So in one version, the attorney was saying, you know, my client suffered these injuries, and it's horrible, and they're demanding $100. In another, they said the same exact scenario, but $20,000. Then they said, you know, $5 million, and they actually tried just to see, like, where it would go, $1 billion. It was like the Austin Powers episode, $1 billion. Well, what we found was really remarkable, right? When they were asking for $100, on average, they were awarded $990. Well, that's like a lot more. It's almost 10 times what they asked for, right? Well, what happens if we ask for $20,000? Well, you know, no, those injuries, everything looks pretty bad. Like, we're going to award $36,000, more than what they were even asking for. Interesting. Does this go on forever? Like, is this exponentially more? Well, no, but at $5 million, they were awarded $440,000. Think about this. The only thing that changed is what they were asked for. So $990,000 and $440,000 are exactly, everything else about that scenario is exactly the same, except for what? The anchor. Except for the fact that this jury didn't know what this was worth. They had to be told what it was worth. When they were told it was worth $100, they're like, nah, I mean, that seems crazy. Maybe it's worth 1,000. When they're told it was worth 5 million, well, that's a little crazy, but 440,000. Everything else was the same. Well, what happens now if I'm like, does it scale forever still? Like, it'll be like $1 billion. No, 490,000. But what we found was that like that then starts to put a framework around the actual value was probably somewhere in here, the actual value of damages, right? But without asking for it being crazy, you know, being more than that, we were unable, without that anchor, people were not comfortable making a decision that high. So how does this apply to us in like the retail world when we're trying to sell something? If you are not displaying a regular price, and I know this is crazy, and I'm going to show you so many things today that you're going to be like, oh yeah, I see that all the time, and oh no, that doesn't get me, it doesn't work on me. Yes, it does. It works on all of you. It works on me. I literally did this for 5 years for a company, and I still like find myself falling for it all the time. It works. So display a regular price. Lichtenstein found something that has been like proven over and over. The relationship between the reference price and perceived value is nearly linear, up to 2.86 times the usual market value. What does that mean? It means that, quite honestly, a $9.99 selling price will, to a consumer, be comfortably accurate if the actual retail price was shown as $27.99. Weird, right? Yet I am going to show you example and example and example, and I'm going to make you do experiments, and now you're going to be like, okay, I'm going to be more cautious now. But it doesn't matter. I'm telling you, I'm going to mess with your brains today. It's still going to work. You know, how can we apply this in our case? I'm going to give you lots of examples too, like obviously just to kind of get the juices flowing, get your brain. How might I do it? I'm not going to give you specifics, but I'm going to give you like overarching. What might we do? Okay, we have this cool Mosaic IPA brewing kit. You know, maybe it's sitting on the shelf. It's cool. You know, it's a great deal. It's $59. You know, maybe they're not moving. Well, are you giving a customer what the anchor is? Is 59 a good deal? I don't know. I mean, I don't price around. Like homebrew shops, right? Very niche business. Are there a lot of them around? Are people, if you are not giving people this anchor, where are they going to get their anchor? Right? Amazon? On their phone? I know this sounds crazy, but that's what happens. We are so starved for the answer to a question, and we have a device in our pocket, all of us right now, that can give us the answer. What we need to do is basically eliminate that as the way that they go to get the answer. When somebody sees this, and try it. I've done this with other, where people are like, okay, whatever. I work with a lot of hotels, and like, whatever. I say, fine, pick me your three worst moving rooms. In your case, pick the three worst moving products in your store. Try everything I talked to you today about those three things. And then come back next year and be like, oh, okay, I don't even, yep, yeah. Because that's what happens. I mean, I didn't invent this stuff. That's why I try to cite every single thing here. It's not me saying this to you. This is decades of research about all this stuff. Now, of course, yeah, that's fun. We're like, oh, we're going to do all these things and everything. But one very important characteristic we can't forget is the feeling of fairness. You know, is a consumer going to feel like, oh, am I getting ripped off? You know, so how do we deal with fairness in feelings? Well, let's look at letter B. And now you're all like, okay, where is he going with this? Well, Kahneman, Ketch, and Thaler did a great experiment, which I love, and I love doing this with people. It's called the ultimatum game. You have $10, all right? You have to split it with a stranger. Now, you both know these rules. So let's say that it's, you know, the two of you right here. I'm going to give you $10. You have to split it with a stranger. If the stranger accepts whatever you offer them, you both get whatever you have, and you go on your merry way a few dollars richer. But if the stranger rejects your offer, neither of you get anything. Okay? So think about that for a second. I have $10. I'm splitting it with the stranger. If the stranger takes what I offer them, we both get whatever that is. We each get that piece of $10. But if the stranger rejects my offer, neither of us get anything. So write down for me, you see on your little form there, it says, I offer whatever out of 10, and what would you do if you were the offerer, and what would you do if you were the recipient? What would you be willing to take? And I'm just going to do my little creepy walk down the aisle thing again. Yeah. So, we needed to get you a form right up front. You got a pen. All right. The pen people. All right. Yeah. Oh. If you guys want to grab one to play along, they're up front on the seats on the right and left. Excellent. Yeah. Oh, you didn't do what you would accept, though. All right. Now, what's interesting is, again, these are repeatable, predictable scenarios. As I walk down this aisle, I see something very common, you know, right, which is like people that say five and five, right? I'll accept $5 and I'll, you know, give $5. So let's start with the, the accepting side of that. I saw more than half of the people I just looked at said that they would accept $5. So if I walked up to you right now, raise a hand for a $5 person, because I forgot. Okay, $5 people. All right. Just, hey, you know what? I really like that pink shirt, looking sharp today. I walk up to you, I give you a dollar. Are you going to say, like, what are you doing? Get up, go away. I don't want that dollar. You keep your dollar. Right? Would that happen? No, the people that said $5, if I walked up to you and I was like, you know, I'm just hey, you know what? I got a bunch of money. Here's $3. You know, are you going to be like, no. You keep your $3. I don't want it. Right? Why does this happen? Why is it that people are saying anything more than a dollar? I did see a couple people that said a dollar. You know, like, well, of course, it's a dollar more than I have right now. Why does that matter? Well, it's because you know that the other person, if you take the dollar, the other person has $9. And what does that not feel? It doesn't feel fair, right? The most common answer is 50-50. You know, most commonly people will say, you know, okay, I'm rationalizing the fairness of the situation. I'm going to give you $5 so that I can keep $5 and we both are $5 richer. Yet in reality, you know, why would you not take a dollar? The average responder accepts $3, okay? Would you not? Does anyone in this room not want $3? If I said at the end here, just come up, I'm going to give you $3. Does anyone that not want that? Right? However, most responders reject $2. What am I trying to get at here? I'm trying to like frame the fact, very important statistic of fairness and feelings. How people react to price is not all, it's not linear forever and good. It also, we have to be very conscious of how people perceive these kinds of things. So, let's say that same thing, you know, that I offer you $9 of that 10, right? I offer you $9. Would you take $9 from me right now? You'd take $9. Right, what if the game, though, was I was given 100 and a split with you and I offered you 9? Yeah, still, well, you're like, you know, but does it feel different? Like, the $9 felt good. You're like, oh, wow, that's cool. He's giving me 9 because you thought maybe it was out of the 10. That's really generous of him. But then you find out, no, it was actually out of 100. And you're like, oh, really? Right? What about, $100? What about, I walk up to you and I say, hey, here's 100 bucks. It feels great. But what if I had just been given $1,000 and asked to split it? Does it feel as good? Very interesting stuff, right? And does it scale forever? You know, someone walks up to you and says, hey, you know what? You know, we're in an office pool or whatever. Like, I'm feeling good today. You don't really know what happened last night, but I come into work today, and I'm like, I'm going to give you $100. And you're like, whoa, that's okay, awesome. Wow, I'm buying lunch. You know, I want you to just have a nice night tonight. Here's $100. You're out in Rhode Island for the thing, you know. Cool. Oh, that feels good, you know, until you find out that I won $1 million yesterday with the caption that I had to split it in some way with somebody and I gave you $100, right? So it's very interesting how we feel and how important that becomes as we talk about pricing. Some good examples of this playing out in the real world. Uber demand pricing, right? Uber demand pricing. Does everyone know what that is? Basically, Uber scales the price of their product, which is transportation, based on how much demand there is for that transportation at that time. So like last night, for example, if anyone was in town, there must have been some kind of an event going on or whatever, and it let out, say, at 10 o'clock. Well, as more and more people are looking for Ubers, Uber scales the price up. However, they do this completely transparently. They actually put right on the thing, demand pricing in effect, 3.6 times whatever. Like, couldn't be more transparent. People still get extremely angry about Uber demand pricing. In the snow in New York City, there have been like crazy, like lengthy New York Times editorials about like demand pricing because they don't want to pay more because it's snowing and there's fewer drivers and there's more demand. People are upset by that. Well, why would you be upset by that? It's completely transparent. You're making the choice, right? It doesn't matter. People take those feelings into account when they're talking about pricing. What's another thing that we see? Super Bowl tickets, right? Well, they actually did some research on what's the best way to sell Super Bowl tickets. Do people prefer an auction, you know, which is honestly like probably the most fair way, like the people who can, I mean, but it's going to skew towards people who have money, okay. a random lottery. Can't get more fair than that, right? It's randomized. I have 10 tickets. 10 people in this room are going to win something, right? Or a line. Wait in line. First people in line are going to get those 10 tickets. What do you think people prefer? By wild margins, the line. People feel like they are not in control of a lottery. They're at a disadvantage, maybe financially, in an auction. But everybody is equal when I'm willing to get up at 4 in the morning and stand in line outside of, you know, your local brewery or to get a ticket to a concert or whatever it is. People perceive the line as more fair. Interesting. So we're going to talk about how this affects in retail with the common theme of losses will always hurt more than gains will feel good. So this is an important part of when we're talking about how we're actually losses are going to hurt your consumer. They're going to impact them negatively more than gains are going to help them. The pain of loss. Another quick little test. Would you prefer a guaranteed $80, right? Or you spin a wheel with a 75% chance of getting $100, but a 25% chance of getting nothing? Would you take $80 right now, or would you rather spin the wheel and take the chance of getting $100, but also the chance of getting nothing? Well, just think about, most people will spin that wheel. Yep. Most people will spin the wheel because they see that the percentage is small, 25%. Let's keep in mind these numbers as we're gonna start digging into how this relates on the next slide. Would you rather pay a fixed $80 price? Now that one was like a win, right? What was that? That was a gain. This is a gain. Would you rather pay a fixed $80 price for your mechanic? Or, you know, this guy's crazy and feeling like a little bit adventurous, you know, and he's like, it was gonna be $80 to fix your computer. But I got this wheel. I just installed it, really want to do something with it. Spin the wheel and you got a 75% chance you pay $100, but a 25% chance you're not going to pay anything. What do you do there? Most people in that case would say, no, I'm just going to pay what I know. I don't want to take this wild chance. Why is that? Because every item with a price causes a customer to experience the pain of loss. As soon as there's a price attached to it, people experience the pain of loss. Now, prices themselves are not one-dimensional. If you're staying at a hotel here, the minibar has kind of gone out of favor recently. But, you know, everyone's seen a hotel minibar, right? Or let's think about, like, something that you see in almost every hotel room today, the bottle of water, right? That bottle of water with that fancy little hang tag. It's like, oh, you can drink this bottle of water for only $5. Well, that sounds, you know. Now, if I said to you, if I walked into a 7-Eleven today and all of a sudden a 12-ounce bottle of water was $5, I'd be like, what in the world? But after your long night of partying at the homebrew con, you know, you're tired, you drag yourself back to your hotel room, you're parched, you open that door, and it's almost like they must have a little tiny spotlight on that little bottle of water. You have all thought about opening that bottle of water. I know it. We've all thought about it, right? Why is that? Because prices are not one-dimensional. If the value is greater than the cost, it's a bargain. If the value is less than the cost, it's what we'd call a ripoff. But they're not one-dimensional. Prices are relevant to the environment and surroundings around them. That bottle of water is more valuable to you at 3 in the morning when you roll into your hotel room than it is when you are, you know, standing at the Target checkout counter and see that same bottle of water. Quick example. Guy's got a, you know, shopping downtown here in beautiful Providence, Rhode Island. You know, I find this awesome t-shirt. I'm like, I'm going to wear this at the next homebrew con. You know, I see it's $20. Not bad. Cool shirt. I go up to the counter and the guy's at the checkout and he's like, hey man, you know, you look like a cool brewer dude. I'm like, oh, thanks. He's like, I'm just going to tell you, I work at the shop down the street too. They have that same shirt. And, you know, we sell it over there for $15. I'm just trying to, oh, well, thanks. What do you do? Who walks down the street? You know? Yeah, I'll tell you what. Most people, when asked this question, are like, yeah, cool. I'll go, you know, thanks. I appreciate the tip. So later this week, I'm out shopping. I need to do TV. You know? Go over to the TV store. And same dude. It's behind the counter. It's like, hey, you know. You work all over the place. He's like, hey, man, I remember you from OBRUCON. I'm like, yeah. I'll tell you what. I also work at the other TV store down the street. And they have this $200 TV, but down there it's only $195. How many of you go down the street for the $195 TV? Yeah. Right? What do most people do? Why? Right? Because it's the same thing. Or is it? Even though the dollar amount is the same, people are more likely to act when a percentage is larger. Crazy, right? How do we use this to our advantage? Show larger discounts. Not give larger discounts. Oh, no, no. Show larger discounts. These two examples, actual split test between two campaigns. Save 15% on your gifts for dad this week during a Father's Day promotion, or save 50% on any one gift for dad under $25. The actual cost to the retailer is exponentially higher on this offer. The consumer behavior, exponentially higher on this offer. Why? People like bigger numbers. People like bigger percentages. You just proved it. You weren't willing to walk down the street for $5 when it came to be a small part of the pie. But when it was like a relatively reasonable part of the pie, you're like, take a stroll. It's a nice day out. So think about that when we're structuring our offers, our incentives, our discounts. Let's talk about making the sale. Number one thing I want to talk about, because I can't, as the Brewers Association service ambassador, not touch on this, sell service. Always sell service. You want to know the difference between you and Amazon? You know, people perceive, believe it or not, people perceive Amazon to be phenomenal at customer service. Call Amazon. What's the number? 1-800-AMAZON? I have no idea, right? Why is that? Because they make it a seamless, easy experience. They don't fight with their customer. They like always, as hard as that is to perceive, that is a huge, what do we have as our advantage? I'm standing in front of you, right? I can help you. I can make this work. Number one complaint online is bad service. People take a quick mental formula of the tangible benefits, intangible service. They subtract the price, and that's how we determine what we would call a value. Was this a good value? You know, we need to focus on value more than price because, you know, we're never going to, I mean, no retailer today is going to be able to really compete on price. We have to almost, like, get that out of our mindset, you know, because where are the price? I mean, you know, the behemoths are always going to have better pricing on their end. Where can we do? We can definitely focus on value, though. As a matter of fact, significant changes to a product quality are actually not a realistic means of affecting customers' value perceptions. What does that mean? Higher quality stuff, like making the thing actually better, does not actually have any effect on people's perception of the value of that item. So we're going to think about that as we talk in actual structure inside of your operation itself. Let's take a quick look at letter C on your letter there. You're on a wait. I just imagine, if you will, a beautiful day like today. You're on a summer white sandy beach. Beautiful day. Your friend offers to go, grab you a beer. I don't know if that's legal here in Providence or whatever, but I mean, we're going to pretend it is. You know, hey, I'm going to go grab some beers. There's only one place, though, to get that beer. I want you to read your description there. He does say, because there's just this one place, you might be paying a little more than you expect. I don't want to spend more of your money than you want to spend. So you tell me what the most you're willing to pay for this beer is, and I won't spend more than that. I'm going to, do my creep down the aisle thing again. I guess I didn't make enough of the papers is the thing. It's like, oh.
I couldn't have a drinking problem.
What are you willing to spend on your beer? What are we willing to spend on a beer? Ooh, I'm hanging out with you later. And it's like we're dealing with beer professionals too, which is always makes this interesting to see the difference in. Excellent. Awesome. All right. So, as you might have expected at this point, obviously you're being given slightly different scenarios. On one side of the room, the only option of where I could go get this beer on this beautiful sunny day near the beach is this high-end resort hotel. They have a fancy, schwanky bar. They're right here, though. They're the only place I can get a beer. Super schwanky. It's upscale. But, I don't want to spend too much of your money. What's the most you're willing to spend? On the other side of the room, it was like, the only place they have beer is this rundown gas station, bodega, like groceries kind of thing over here. It's not pretty. And it's probably going to be expensive because they're the only game in town. How much are you willing to spend? as we can duplicate in any environment whatsoever, we got remarkably different answers, even though the scenario has nothing to do with where the beer comes from. You are going to consume this beer on the beach. You are all consuming it in the exact same place, in the exact same way, from the exact same container. Yet, for some reason, people that knew that the beer was coming from an upscale, fancy place were willing to spend more than the people who thought it was coming from a rundown grocery bodega or gas station store, I believe is the actual word. Rundown gas station store. Interesting, right? Why is that? As a matter of fact, when this was done by Richard Thaler in 1982, and a lot has changed in beer since then, people were willing to spend at the rundown grocery store only $1.70 on average, and at the upscale hotel bar, they were willing to spend $5.65. Now, obviously, a lot has changed in that much time, especially about beer, but it still holds true. The ambiance in this scenario is completely irrelevant, but the upscale hotel was also assumed to be fair at charging their $5.62, and the rundown grocery store was actually considered to be a ripoff. Why is that? It's because we are selling atmosphere, right? Assess your ambiance. Stopped the whole presentation. Assess your own ambiance, both physical and digital. Now, when I talk to brewers and stuff about this, I usually use this as kind of an example when I'm talking to them about like how we've gotten very industrial. You know, breweries are getting more and more and more and more. Like, now you're like walking in and it's like, we've got a stack of pallets and some folding chairs. We're industrial. People will definitely, it will affect what they're willing to spend on in your environment. It also has that same impact on the web. If any of you, earlier this morning, we heard about it getting into the e-commerce, doing some online commerce, online selling. There's a great research paper called When Web Pages Influence Choice, Effects of Visual Primes on Experts and Novices. Basically, what they did is they had a mattress store online, you know, an online mattress store, and the only thing that they changed was the background image. Now, these aren't the real images, but one was clouds and happiness, and one was currency. So it was pennies or dollars, and it was emphasis on dollars. What they found is that they then looked at who bought the cheapest mattress, the number of people that bought the cheapest mattress in each of these scenarios. In the cloud version, 39% bought the cheapest mattress. However, in the one with currency as the background image, 56% bought the cheapest mattress. So very similarly to like assessing the ambiance from a how do we make this experience feel like it's more valuable, we could be doing that same thing in our online presence by simply the imagery that we're using. Our customers today prefer to buy an experience. We heard it this morning, right? 21 to 35 prefer to spend their money on experiences over goods. They want more, they want to experience something rather than have something. Guess what? Homebrewing is an experience. You know, build experiences if you don't already offer them. Can I come brew with you? Can I come brew someplace? Can I come, you know, tour a brewery with someone who, like you, who really knows about breweries? As a matter of fact, Airbnb launched this month a full-on push, Airbnb experiences. They know this is where the consumer is going. What they're doing now is trying to connect people with who want to do something interesting or extreme or different with someone local who understands that. You know who would be primed to sign up to list their experiences on here? Everyone in this room. I bet almost all of you, if you have some type of experiential event that you host or you would host or you could host if it meant pre-booked dollars via Airbnb. So think about that. Sell experiences. Direct focus. Customers will focus on price by default. It takes manipulation to get them to pay attention to anything else. This is a quote from William Poundstone in a great book called Priceless. If you want an easy read about pricing, I'd suggest this book is great. It takes manipulation. So let's talk about how we can do that. I'm going to give you an example using some of our favorite things, beers. This is actual research from the Journal of Consumer Research. We have two beers. We have a premium beer, of course, Duff. Its rating is 70 out of 100, and we have a bargain beer. Its rating is 50 out of 100. We know that the premium beer is $2.60 a bottle, and we know the bargain beer is $1.80. What do you think people do when presented with these two options? Just think for yourself what you might do. What we know is that about two-thirds, in this case, take the difference and say, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll go premium. Yeah, it's better rated. It's not that much more money. You know, I'm going to go premium. And I bet everyone in this room probably would be like, of course, premium. You know, so it's a bad, you know, I use it because it's actually statistical data that was done with beer. But yeah, we're not the audience here. oh, man, this, I don't know why it keeps stopping the slideshow. So now, there we go. Now we introduce a third beer, the discount beer. So we have premium, 70 out of 100, bargain, 50 out of 100, and beer, 40 out of 100. 260, 180, 160. Just think to yourself what happens now, right? So what we see happen is an almost even split happens between premium and bargain, right? Still not a lot of people going for the super cheapo brand, but an almost even split between premium. What happened there? We actually pulled some people that were willing to spend on the premium away and down to bargain. Keep that in mind. This is very important. Well, let's go the other direction. We introduced super premium, you know, 75, a little better rated. You know, this is like the beer that you guys drink, that I drink, right? 340, yeah, for a bottle. Premium, still, and bargain. But what do we do? Let's drop that cheap crap beer at the end. What happens here? Well, what we see happens here is what's very important. Almost everyone shifts to this middle choice, right? The premium choice. It's not that much different than the super premium in rating, you know, and it's fairly different, significantly different in price. What did we do there? I'll give you this example. When we introduce the low price, low quality option, what we actually see that happens is we draw people down to a lower choice up here. When we do the inverse and we introduce a super premium option, eliminating the super junky option, we actually pull people up into making choices that are what we call compromise choices, safe choices, compromise choices. This is universally applicable. I'm going to share some examples right now with you. But number one that I know that you think about or never have thought about until right this moment is this here. Batteries. You've all bought batteries. There's no way we can go through life without ever going out and shopping for batteries, right? And we go and we look at batteries and we have like Green Cell and EverReady and all these like weird. And then we have Duracell and we have Energizer, right? What's the difference between these batteries? Nobody knows. I am convinced that literally nobody knows. You know, they're all 1.5 volt. They're all size AA. You know, they all fit into and will operate my Discman or whatever it is we're operating. But quite honestly, we have no idea beyond that except for what? The price. That's how we shop for batteries. You know who knows that? The Duracell and Energizer people. You know one thing you will never see? Duracell and Energizer batteries on sale at the same time. Why? They are taking turns being the super premium, right? You go in and you're like, well, there's Duracell and Energizer. One is $8 for the package, one's $6.99. Which one are you buying? I promise you there are very few of you that are like, I am diehard. I only will ever buy the Duracell. No. You're like, ah, this one's $6.99. I need batteries, right? Think about that. We do it all the time. It goes all the way up. Has anyone ever been into a Prada store? Yeah. I mean, there's always someone who'll admittedly like, I mean, I've. So you walk in, right? This store, big white cube with like, you know, 9 items displayed. But in the middle of the room, on this like fancy little pedestal with like a bag attendant, there's this $9,000 bag, you know, and you're like, what the, what's a, you know, and you can go over and you're like, oh, welcome to Prada. Would you like to approach the bag? Yeah, yeah, okay, yeah, I'll sign me up for some, yeah. But no, like, why is that there? Because when you walk into Prada and you see that example, what you're saying, somebody must be buying that bag. Somebody's buying that thing, right? The truth is, nobody's buying that thing. They're giving these away to celebrities. You know, they're getting them out there. But why are they doing that? Because you walk in, you're like, I'm not going to buy a $9,000 bag. That's insane, right? But this $40 keychain seems like reasonable suddenly. Right? Oh, you've done it. I'm telling you, like, I love when someone admits it because I know inside, or I'm like, okay, yeah, I bet. This is called the anger-happiness mixture. Sensory Logic did this. Basically, upper-middle-class consumers are angry because they can't afford these, like, super fancy celebrity things. The knee-jerk reaction is to make themselves happy buying something else. Right? Do we ever see that in our industry at all, maybe? Oh, that's, yeah. But think about that, right? It could be done. It's applicable in any environment. You know, we can see that happen in any industry. Williams-Sonoma. Anyone here been into Williams-Sonoma? You know, this is another great example. And this is starting, now we're starting to dig into things that actually, like, you might be able to apply this right on your shelf right now. They were selling this Cuisinart bread maker. Probably perfectly fine. You know, makes great bread. It's $279. They weren't moving, though. They're out there. I mean, you're like, oh, $279. I mean, it makes bread. Put things in and bread comes out. Cool. Well, they introduced another bread maker. Because these are smart marketing people. They have tons of research dollars going into what they do. You go in there and you're like, oh, now next to this $279 Cuisinart, they introduced this $429 fancier bread maker that has, like, Wi-Fi. So, you can, I mean, I don't, you know, what happened when they introduced that? Any idea what happens? They doubled the sales of the $279 bread maker. Because people suddenly felt comfortable because you were in Williams-Sonoma and you're like, well, I don't need the $429. I don't need Wi-Fi. Now suddenly this $279 bread maker seems like a reasonable use of your dollars. You know, do you have a homebrew kit on your shelf right now? How many of you sell a kit prepackaged? Like, I could buy this, right? How many versions of that do you have? If you do not have a super premium, shiny, crazy, woo, look at that one. Well, I mean, I don't need that one. But I mean, all of a sudden, this one seems like a really good deal, right? Let's think about how we can apply this in our environments. This is called extremeness aversion. If consumers are uncertain, they're going to shy away from the most expensive, the least expensive, the highest quality. They're going to avoid all the extremes and the trade-off contrast. If one is clearly better than the other, they're going to select X, even if they can't figure out why. So this is all that stuff that came from the very beginning when we talked about, like, how people are easy to kind of, you need to help them make a choice. If you have options, if you have online, if you have, you know, an online presence, tell people what they want. Highlight the correct choice. You've all seen something like this, right? You've signed up for some service online where you are like, I don't really, I mean, I just need the basics of whatever they do, and I get to this page, and what do I do? Well, I mean, I guess I should go with Plus. I mean, that's the most popular, right? We've actually done this for businesses. Tell people what they want. Tell people what the right choice is. Serial position effect. The first and last items of any list our consumers will believe are the worst choices. You've done this at a wine list, all of you. Because once in a while, you don't have to admit it, but you'll go and you'll drink wine. We don't tell anybody that, but it happens, right? And you look at this wine list and you're like, okey-doo. I'm like, what? I look, skip down, go a little up from the bottom. That one seems good. Right? We've all done it. This is an example of a client we worked with. They literally wanted to sell, they were happy to sell the $20 plan. There at the time, that was like, they only had a $20 and a $50 offering. They were having trouble with people believing that it was worth the $20 and they weren't getting anyone to do the fit. The craziest thing is all we did was add a $3,000 package underneath. Suddenly, people were like, $20 is a great deal. I'm going to sign up for that. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to show this video, but there's a great video on extremeness aversion. Basically, The Economist had three subscription models. They have the regular for $59, print for $125, or print and the web for, so I can get web for one. I mean, what happens there? Why would you even offer that? Well, the reason they offered it is because people need those choices in order to make a smart choice. They need those options in order to feel comfortable with their choice. Offer at least three price categories, even if they're not logical. I have a web thing for $59, I have print for $125, or I have print and web for $125. What do you think people are going to pick? Obviously, I'm like, well, I mean, I might as well go with the web one, right? Let a consumer make that right choice for themselves. Adding a slightly worse option will give consumers something to make the easier comparison with. Have a dummy offer directly adjacent to the thing you're actually trying to sell. So remember this homebrew kit example? We've got our super premium, right? And we have the one we actually know we make good money on, high margins. This is like the, it's good, it's going to work, they're going to be happy with it, they're going to come back and buy things from me. Do we have some like cardboard box with like a pan we picked up at the dollar store? I'm not saying that that's like what we have to do, but, you know, helping consumers make that package, and we're going to talk about packaging in just a moment. Also, the nine, right? All of you are like, you think this doesn't affect you because it's so ambiguous. $19.99, $29.99, $49.99. People sell houses and they list their houses at $349,900. Oh, right, you fooled me. Not, that's not $350. I'm saving bundles here. Why do we do that? Believe it or not, there's tons of research that have gone into the fact that people will always pick the price that ends in a nine. There's actually like researchers that have done so much research that they have concluded that they have no idea why this is. You know, when shown those as two options, 3-1, people will pick the 39 over the 40. Crazy enough, it doesn't even work when the, it doesn't even matter what the price is. I'm going to skip ahead to one of these. Using all these pieces kind of put together, that outsells both of these options. 5-1. Because why? Now you guys are starting to put pieces together. We have an anchor. Okay, it's regularly $49. Yeah. So now it's on sale, a call to action. Well, maybe it is, maybe it's not. And I'm selling it for $39. That $39 is the same as that $39, but that $39 converts 5 times more often. Right? Still $39. There's actually research that has been done where the price was higher but ended with a 9. Like a $49 item outselling a $47 item. The same item. Right? People love a deal. How do we know this with 1,000% certainty in today's age? JCPenney. Several years ago, in an effort to rebrand their whole thing, they eliminated sales. And instead, we're like, we have everyday fair square pricing. Everything's fair. You know, we're just going to have fair prices. Like these are the prices we were selling you on sale. We're going to make that our everyday price. What happens? People stop shopping at JCPenney. They want the deal. The thing that they're going in there now that's $39 was the sale price before was $39. Today I could just go in and get it for $39, but I don't feel as excited about it. You know, $39. I'll wait for it to go on sale. It's not going on sale. You don't understand our things. No. Nearly like collapsed the JCPenney empire. They're still struggling to recover from that. So people love the idea of a bargain, even if we don't think we do. Sometimes you need to price things a little bit up. You need to increase your prices, right? Avoid large price increases. Weirdly enough, Ernst Weber in 1831 developed what he called Weber's Law, which basically boils down to people can't perceive a difference in any stimuli so long as it's under about 10%. He did it with, they've done it with temperature, they've done it with pressure, they've done it with all kinds, but people lack the ability to necessarily perceive a change in anything under 10%. So if you do need to increase the price on something, do it in small increments. Do it under, you know, maybe it needs to go up 20%. Do it, you know, 12%. Instead of doing 12% now, do 6 and 6 over a period of time. You can get there, but people won't perceive it if it's under 10%. This is a video that, again, I'm not going to play the actual video, but you know, you remember this back in the day. The fabulous Ginsu knife. It chops, it cuts. I mean, you can, you know, cut it. I don't know if there's, let's see.
It's a knife that no kitchen should be without. The Ginsu can cut a slice of bread so thin you can almost see through it. It cuts meat better than an electric knife and goes through frozen food as though it were melted butter. The Ginsu is so sharp it can cut through a tin can and still slice a tomato like this.
And I don't know if you remember, but at the end of this ad, you know, it's like, you get the Ginsu knife, you get the side knife, you get the chopping blade, you get the chopping block, you get all the, it's like 45 different things that I get. But wait, here you go, but it comes with a magic fork, and it comes with this, and we have this little pocket knife, and, you know, and it's like, but wait, there's more. This was like the first commercial to say, but wait, there's more, we're not done. You can slice, you can peel, you can dice, you can do all these things. In that entire ad, do you know what word they never use once? They never say free. This is a mistake a lot of people make in retail. None of those things were free. You get this, you get this, you get this, we give you this, we get this, we get this, we're even going to ship it to you at no cost. We never use the word free. Avoid words like free and complimentary. They devalue the offering. Instead, we're going to use included, featured. Price your included items. Create value for the customer. When I buy, you know, we're going to include a recipe or a list of our personal homebrew recipes included with any purchase you make today. It's a $9 value. Is it? I don't know.
Yeah.
Made that up, right? Brewing 101 class. You guys have a class of some variety? You know, I'm going to include this Brewing 101 class with any purchase over $250. This is a $79 value. What did I just do? I made someone more comfortable to bring. Maybe, you know, your average ticket, maybe your average sale, you know, of a homebrew kit is $200. And you want to pull it to $250. Does that, what does that take? Are you already doing a class? Does it have any cost to have an extra person in it? You know, what, I mean, think about what you can do and point out the value of that thing. You might not even have a class, but you know what? I'd throw it for the guy that spent $250. You know? That's what it takes. Like, create value. Explain the value. You know who's fantastic at explaining value? These guys. Dyson sells a vacuum cleaner, right? I can go into a store and buy a $50 vacuum cleaner, or I can buy the, I think this thing is like $500 for a vacuum cleaner. I always wanted to be a vacuum cleaner sales guy because I'd be like, this one sucks. And like, nobody knows, but, you know. But what do they do? How do they sell a $500 vacuum cleaner? They talk about the value, explain the value. 5 years of prototypes, 5,100 prototypes, 1,000 engineers and scientists and fluid dynamics. Do you care about that, about your vacuum cleaner? Of course not. But they yet maintain their place as an extremely successful vacuum cleaner and fan company by promoting the value. So when we have that fancy homebrew kit, talk about signage. Explain to the customer, why is that worth what you're asking for? Help me make that choice, right? Don't send me to Amazon to look at customer reviews. Instead, tell me, what, why is this? Oh, okay, well, it's made here, it does this. Use small words. A split test on a free, what, a trial of a DVD trial for a very popular DVD company. They did a split test on the free trial, having it either be a $5 fee or a small $5 fee. Literally, the only difference between them was the one word. Defining the $5 as small, 20% better conversion with the word small. Use words small, minor, low. You know where you see this all the time? You don't even think about it because you're numb to it. Like, everyday low prices, low price guarantee, right? We see it all the time, but why are they doing that? Low, small, pointing that out. How do we use this in our world? There's a small handling charge of $4.95 for a custom size hop order. That will actually be less impactful in creating that fear of loss, creating that stress, than just saying there's a $4.95 handling charge. Small, point that out. Tag products in lists with key phrases. If you have a lot of options, tell people what they want. Best value, best choice, most popular. You know, if you don't have like complex web abilities, and you know, or just put it right on the image. Plop it right over the image you're using. You don't have to get fancy. Look at that page. What's the thing on this page that draws your attention? This is from one of the big behemoth homebrew places, right? What draws your attention here? What are you looking at? They're doing everything. Literally all the things we talked about. It's new. What does that even, I mean, it's like new. That's an easy one to use, but it draws your attention up here. Here's the anchor price. Here's what we're selling it for. So think about all these pieces. Remove risk whenever you can remove risk. Guaranteed satisfaction. This sounds crazy, but you know why companies do this? You know why big brands are like, you know why Amazon will take pretty much anything back? Because like statistically, the cost of that is negligible to the goodwill that they build by doing that. Satisfaction guarantee. We want you to love your choice. If for any reason you were not completely satisfied, just let us know and we're going to make it right. This doesn't say anything about dollars. Say anything. What does it say? This is something every one of you could offer, right? Because just let me know. We're going to make it right. It's going to be different in every scenario. But, you know, give me the comfort of being like, okay, well, you know what? It's guaranteed. I can take the chance on this fancy homebrew kit because, you know, these guys are going to stand behind it. And you would, right? All the small business. I mean, like, of course you would. If somebody really had a problem with something in that or didn't understand it or needed a little bit and they came back in and they had just spent $500 with you, everyone in this room is certainly going to be like, of course I'm going to spend a little bit of time with you and help you figure that out. Put that out there. Make it a part of your message. You know, offer different sizes when you can. Bracketing. Applies in any industry. I wrote an article for the BA a couple of years ago called The Value of Fractional Pours about, you know, if we offered things in different sizes. You know what happens when we offer these three options? You see, it's not linear, right? I can't multiply the 4 ounce by four. It's not the same price. I'm paying quite a bit more for the smaller portion, right? Hops, grain, whatever you might be breaking, whatever you bracket. What happens when we offer this, though? People go for that one. It's a safe choice. It seems like the safest. I was at Rogue Alehouse or whatever, Rogue Kitchen, whatever. Awesome. Great beer list and all, right? Literally, they have full pours for $10, half pours for $5.50, and tastes for like $3.75. What are people in there doing? I'm looking around. What are they doing? Oh, trying, starting with the taste. Why? That taste is exponentially more profitable than the full pour, right? How can we do that in our environments? What can we break down? And finally, let's not neglect our regular customers, the people that are, you know, that are coming in all the time. They're your bread and butter. They're your friends, right? Private newsletter. Sounds crazy? Send them a private email just for our best and most loyal customers. Offer them an employee discount and call it that. You know, maybe you already have 10% off for like, don't call that. Call it an employee discount. Why? Consumers perceive that to be the best discount you could possibly get, right? I mean, like employee discount. You right now hearing that, you're probably thinking, yeah, that sounds different than 10% off, right? I'm gonna, you know, you're so loyal to us. You've been so great to us over the years. We're gonna extend to you our employee discount. You know, it's 10%. Make it weird. People like weird numbers. They feel more intellect, like more thought went into them. So instead of it being a 10% discount, maybe offer them 8.5%. Like, I know it sounds crazy, but you can literally say, we're going to give you our employee discount. It's 11.3%. And they're like, oh, well, that sounds very intentional. Now they're like, okay, 11.3. I guess that's what they make on their stuff. Wow, they really aren't making as much as I thought. Maybe I'll spend some more money in there, send my friends down there. Coordinate events. Build on those experiences. Work with breweries. Work with neighboring things. What can you do to bring people together to incorporate what you're doing with what they're doing? Create experiences. Package them and sell them. Now, I know I went, like, you know, all the way to the end there, mostly because of my acrobatics. I'm going to go up and down the aisle and pen quest, which now I've learned. Yeah. Bring mini pencils. I own a mini golf course. I have, like, infinite supply of tiny little pencils. I don't know why I didn't bring that here. But I will, you know, give a few minutes. I know it's we're at the end there. But, I mean, if anyone has any questions, otherwise, I will see you around HomebrewCon and at the reception tonight. And I'm always happy to chat about anything beer related. So thank you very much for your time. Oh, there is someone. Yep. Oh, there is someone. Yeah, he turned it off because I said there were no questions. But he'll turn it. Oop. He's. But I. Okay. Yep. Sure. Cool. I'll repeat it if you.
Okay.
What's your question?
Yep.
Yep, so there are states that have passed legislation that say that if you want to list something as a regular price, it has to have actually been sold at that price. So there are states that are trying to, basically his question was, there are he's seen in places where there's an asterisk and it says it may not actually be the offering price. You see it actually quite a bit on car dealers because they have been subject of some lawsuits about that. So there are states where you have to have sold it at that price at some point. Now, that said, that's not something that's affected this industry. You know, that's not something that's necessarily been applicable to the under $200 average ticket retail market yet. That's something that they're really focused on, though, on like those big ticket, you know, saying that a car is like $79,900 and we're selling it for $34,000. You know, that's kind of what they're talking about there. I don't advocate for like making up ridiculous prices that are outside of where something would normally be. But there are times of year that, you know, that you wouldn't, you know, if something is always the same price, always on sale, you start to make your consumer numb to the fact that that was ever. So rotate through what you're doing. Use that advantage to focus on the things you're trying to move. So if you have, you know, this week you want to move something else, shift kind of that focus and that marketing over to that item and put that other item back to regular price.
What are
In retail, fear, like FOMO, which is just the fear of missing out, is easily it, in the beer industry as a whole, it applies in so many different places, right? Because people will still stand in line for a beer release. You know, so there's still this, like, if I didn't have the opportunity, this industry kind of bucks the normal trend. We have done on hospitality. Well, I'll give you a good example. Airbnb launching the experiences campaign created a $5,000 package of travel to following around the world in 80 days. 80-day adventure package, $5,000, marketed as if it was going to be something people could buy. However, then last minute was like, oh, we're only actually doing a very small and specific number of these on these specific days. And the only way that you can be part of that is if you follow us on our social media channels. So yes, I mean, it's still effective when executed properly, but at the same time in a retail environment, like the urgency to buy is not necessarily there in the same way that it is. And if you can cultivate that, absolutely. Holiday time, that's definitely a time you might be able to manipulate that. You know, as you approach Black Friday and whatnot, you know, limited numbers of things. You can certainly say there are 4 available. There might be 34 available. But, you know, you can certainly put emphasis on, you know, like, you know, the first 10 people will get this if you're trying to drive that kind of, you know, getting creative. I'm all for always, like, and try it. You know, the nice part about being small business owners is that we can turn on a dime, right? If something doesn't work, you're like, well, I'm not going to do that anymore, and you try something new. So. Cool. Well, thank you, guys.